Hello, this is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, we begin this week's Triangle Business Journal with a look at the biz page as usual. And under the heading of New Store comes the article, Chapel Hill's Sutton's Drug Shows More and Graham. Sutton's Drug Store has been a gathering spot for folks in Chapel Hill for more than 90 years now. It's become locally famous for its burgers, breakfast, and vintage soda and candies. The place is billed as a drugstore that mixes Tar Heel tradition with a bit of old-school charm. So Biz has painted the picture now, a local Chapel Hill spot that's steeped in Tar Heel culture, right? A second Sutton's opened up shop in downtown Graham at the end of last year in the spot of the old Reich Pharmacy. Clay Penny, owner of the spinoff, spent a lot of time in the original store location. And after moving to Graham, he decided to open up his shop. In the new place, most of the shelves were left empty, so customers could fill it with knickknacks and paraphernalia in order for it to have a community feel. And while there's now certainly a lot of Tar Heel stuff, there's one small, tiny section dedicated to the Duke Blue Devils. Wait, what? And under the heading of Looking East comes the article, DeSimone mentions North Carolina for future expansion of firm. Before becoming the headline-grabbing, award-winning CEO of buzzy Silicon Valley startup Carbon, Joseph DeSimone was a chemistry professor at UNC Chapel Hill and NC State University. So it's no surprise that, now in California, he talks up the Triangle any chance he gets. As we think about a second site for Carbon, we know damn well North Carolina is in our crosshairs, he says, in a recent interview. While Silicon Valley has scale, the scale in the valley and the depth is really, really immense. North Carolina has the diversity. The two regions have a lot to teach each other, he says. And under the heading of New Bar comes the article, Duo Preps to Open Lounge in Raleigh. You'll have to get a key if you want to saddle up to the newest bar coming to North Person Street. Jason Howard and Dan Murphy, part of the team behind the Cardinal Bar, is opening an underground watering hole at 620 North Person Street called the Atlantic Lounge, accessed via a doorway between Crawford & Son and Pelagic Beer and Wine. Howard is calling it a social experiment and says the goal is to allow the neighborhood to kind of take over the membership situation and have their own bar. They can come and go as they please with a key, obviously within operating hours. While making the club exclusive to the neighborhood inherently limits revenue, the overhead costs are low, Howard says, and he's willing to take a chance. Residents of the Oakwood neighborhood will be able to purchase a key, which will cost somewhere between $15 to $25 per year. Next year, Howard has plans to open the Rainbow Luncheonette at the old Rainbow Upholstery Building at 911 Northwest Street. The eatery will serve breakfast and lunch and open its doors all day on Saturdays. Howard is shooting for a spring 2019 opening and is aiming to soak up some of the customers left when Finch's moved to Durham. And under the heading of Carolina Bound comes the article, Looking to Go Somewhere This Summer? Look no further. Thinking of road tripping this summer? You need not look further than the old North State. According to a recent Wallet Hub survey, North Carolina ranked the number two best road trip destinations for summer. It received top 10 marks in the country in several categories, including lowest price of three-star hotel room, ranking of ninth, access to scenic byways, ranked seventh, and driving law rating, ranked seventh. A number of other factors were included in the state's overall average score of 56.24, including average gas prices, number of attractions, and lowest price of camping. For those curious, Wyoming led the pack with a total score of 58.75. And under the heading of retail comes the article, Durham's South Point welcomes a new shirt store. Biz already feels a bit more relaxed. Untuckit, the shirt brand designed to be worn untucked, is opening a bricks-and-mortar store at Durham's Streets of South Point. It's the brand's first North Carolina store, and is located on the mall's lower level between Nordstrom and Belk. The 1,700-square-foot location opened on June 15th and is UNTUCKit's 32nd store nationwide. The store houses the brand's full assortment and includes a casual lounge area and fitting rooms. UNTUCKit, founded by Chris Riccobono and Aaron San Andres, began as an online concept and opened its first retail location in 2015 in New York City's Soho area. Other locations include Boston, Pittsburgh, Atlanta, and Chicago. And rounding out this week's biz page under the heading of education comes the article, Program Developed to Address Need for Women in STEM Fields. About 6 months into his new role as general manager in the U.S. for pharmaceutical engineering firm NNE, Gary Lohr is hoping to help in addressing the gap of women working in STEM fields. STEM, as you know, is an acronym for science, technology, engineering, and math. Lohr previously served as director and deputy site head of Novo Nordisk in Johnson County and part of the management team overseeing the company's $2 billion manufacturing expansion in Clayton over the past 3 years. On June 14, Lohr and the rest of the team at NNE hosted 20 female high school students at their base in Durham for an engineering-focused STEM workshop. The pilot program was developed by Franklin Academy junior Megan Rogers in conjunction with the Girls Engineering Change programs at Duke University and NC State University. "It's an absolutely incredible program," says Lohr, "giving young women the opportunity to learn firsthand from female role models in various fields of engineering, a real cross-section of the industry. One particular area of market need in engineering at the moment is automation," he says. Most recent numbers from the U.S. Department of Commerce show that women fill only 24% of STEM jobs nationwide. Now we turn to the tech and transportation page for this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of No Fly Zone comes the article, Unauthorized Drone Spotted in North Carolina Skies. A pilot flying over the Triangle on October the 17th reported a close call with a drone, an occurrence that's on the rise nationally. According to a report disclosed by the Federal Aviation Administration, the pilot saw a drone flying at the same altitude as the aircraft, 2,500 feet. The pilot didn't catch a detailed description of what he saw, but the Johnston County Sheriff's Office was notified. No evasive action was taken in the skies that time, but it's more evidence that nearly 2 years after the FAA's drone regulations went into effect, pilots keep breaking the rules in North Carolina and beyond. And accompanying this article, there's a small graph indicating the 2017 drone sightings in North Carolina by quarter. So in the first quarter, 11, the second quarter, 10, quarter 3, 15, and quarter 4, 20. And under the heading of Silicon Valley Bound comes the article, Who else did Cooper meet while in San Fran? Not Apple. 30 minutes. That's how long Governor Roy Cooper was supposed to spend at a meeting in San Francisco's April 27th that never happened. While the name of the company has been redacted from his itinerary, provided more than a month after the trip at the behest of a public records request, sources confirm it was Apple, currently in end-stage negotiations with North Carolina for a corporate campus. While the time is mapped out on a draft itinerary, an updated document listing Cooper's actual activities show he instead visited Stanford for a full hour before heading out to complete his schedule. From Stanford, he headed to Cisco. Cooper also visited Carbon, Google, and LinkedIn. And under the heading of Light Rail comes the article, Orange County Commish, Not Spending More Than We Agreed To on Light Rail. As Go Triangle looks for ways to fill the funding gap left by state legislators when it comes to the long-planned Durham-Orange Light Rail Transit System, commissioners, at least in Orange County, don't want to foot more of the bill. That's according to hundreds of pages of emails provided at the behest of a public records request. In addition to discussing liability issues during a closed session, particularly what would happen if Orange County pulled out of the project, commissioners worked to craft a statement on their stance. The biggest concern? Making sure the county's position on funding was clear. I've had several conversations with Durham commissioners and Go Triangle folks, and I've made sure to remind everyone that we are not spending more than we agreed to, wrote Chairman Mark Dorison, and they've all indicated they understand that. My concern is that there will be a push from Go Triangle or others to have the county boards of Durham and Orange pick up the shortfall, much as we have in the past, Commissioner Earl McKee responded. Let's just see how this plays out. Even with the technical corrections bill, the latest budget would leave a funding gap Go Triangle would have to figure out a way to fill in order to complete the 17.7-mile project. Jeff Mann, Go Triangle's general manager, says his organization is still reviewing its options. And wrapping up all the articles on the Tech and Transportation page under the heading of Aviation comes the article, RDU Cites Next Three Markets on Its Wish List. As officials were announcing Raleigh-Durham International Airport's latest win, the addition of six new nonstop routes to its network June 13th, behind the scenes, they were already trying to line up the next opportunity. As Denver-based Frontier Airlines announced its latest batch of new nonstop flights out of RDU to Montego Bay, Jamaica, Punta Cana, Dominican Republic, Cancun, Mexico, Fort Myers, Florida, West Palm Beach, Florida, and Phoenix, Arizona, airport officials were eyeing their next targets, picked both for demand and economic development outlook. Topping the priority list is Norman Mineta, San Jose International Airport in the heart of Silicon Valley, says Christy Van Auken, Vice President of Community Affairs and Communications at RDU. And it's followed by two other destinations, Oregon's Portland International Airport and Aeropuerto Internacional Benito Juarez in Mexico City. San Jose, a city that was once served out of RDU by the now-defunct Midway Airlines, shares a slew of big-name technology firms with RDU. And it's an essential stop for entrepreneurs raising money, says Josie DeSimone, the UNC Chapel Hill professor-turned-founder of Silicon Valley's Carbon, which has raised more than $400 million to advance 3D printing technology. DeSimone, a frequent flyer between RDU and the West Coast, says a nonstop flight between the two metros is increasingly important, especially for big ideas. Rick Vandeven, Raleigh-based director of River City's Capital Funds, points out that in addition to making it easier for investors to discover the entrepreneurial scene of the Triangle, a connection could facilitate more HQ2 discussions and encourage more talent to explore the Triangle as their next home. And it's worth saying that Apple, which is negotiating with the state of North Carolina over locating a hub in Research Triangle Park, is headquartered in nearby Cupertino, just a 15-minute drive from the airport. Even without a nonstop, an average of 84 passengers per day each way are traveling between RDU and San Jose, according to RDU statistics. Even without a nonstop flight, about 84 people per day are traveling between Portland and RDU. Portland and the Triangle share a slew of employers, such as Google, IBM, and Oracle, which have footprints in both regions. Portland companies have also been making major investments in the Triangle. Examples include Avangrid Renewables, a Portland energy company that invested in the leasing rights for what could someday be North Carolina's first offshore wind farm off the coast of Kitty Hawk. As Vandeven points out, like the Triangle, it's another up-and-coming entrepreneurial hub. Already, about 64 passengers travel between Mexico City and RDU per day each way, according to RDU estimates, and that's also without a nonstop flight. In addition to being a tourist destination, it's the capital of North Carolina's second-largest export market, behind Canada and ahead of China, as Mike Walden, economist and NC State University professor, points out. Now we turn to this week's Life Sciences page. Under the heading of Pharmaceuticals comes the article, Right to Try, Friend or Foe? Local experts weigh in. With President Donald Trump signing a new Right to Try bill passed by Congress late last month, local experts are weighing in on right-to-try legislation and potential impacts on patients and drug development moving forward. The new federal law joins existing right-to-try laws in some 40 states, including North Carolina, that aim to aid terminally ill patients in accessing drugs not yet approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration when there are no other options. I'm definitely in favor of getting drugs to patients as quickly as possible to help with their disease, but we've got to have controls in this, says Brandon Early, Vice President of Clinical Development at Raleigh-based contract research organization PRA Health Sciences. That's what we rely on the FDA to do. Tom Finnegan, Chairman and CEO of Clarkson Consulting, calls himself a fan of Right to Try. I'm an optimist, and I think even with imperfect information, if a patient wants to try ideally, we can do it in such a way that eliminates the liability for the other manufacturers or the caregivers, he said. But there are tangible concerns for patients and drug developers. I'm a huge opponent of Right to Try and have been for 25 years, says David Shoemaker, Senior Vice President of Research and Development at Chapel Hill-based contract research organization ROE, which will soon be expanding into a new headquarters in Raleigh in Research Triangle Park. I just think that the legislation around this in the States is so fraught with assumptions that the products are safe after phase one, when in fact, that is not the case, he says, adding that 90% of drugs fall out. There's the possibility that these experimental drugs could hurt patients. Ultimately, however, companies still have to agree to treat patients when it comes to Right to Try, notes Early. And under the heading of Growing Fast comes the article, WellCare Health Eyes Second State and Hires Hundreds. Home health provider WellCare Health, which has regional offices in Wilmington, Raleigh, and Advance, is growing its leadership team and overall headcount as it plots growth outside of North Carolina and in the new area of care. The company has hired Susan Jackson as its chief people officer, a new role for the company that will focus on talent acquisition and retention, as well as leadership development and compensation and benefits. For WellCare Health, there's critical need in terms of talent. The company's recently grown from 800 employees to 1,000 and doesn't plan on stopping there. We're planning to expand into South Carolina, and we're also looking for adding hospice services in the future as well, says WellCare's Jennifer Cassio. There's currently a focus on becoming a total post-acute care provider, she says, adding that hospice services to start would be based in the Triad region of the state. The growth in general that we've experienced in the last several years was the driving force behind having a chief people officer, says Cassio. Before joining WellCare Health, Jackson most recently served as the chief operating officer of Morrisville-based pharmacy services startup C3 Healthcare RX. She also previously served as vice president of health delivery redesign at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina and spent more than two decades at Wake Med Health and Hospitals in human resources and operations. I was introduced to WellCare through a medication management pilot for Triangle Area patients and my chief operating officer role with C3 Healthcare RX, says Jackson. Through that startup work, I met Zach Long, who's CEO, Wanda Cooley, who's COO, and other members of WellCare's leadership team. And under the heading of CEO Transition comes the article, After $150 Million Deal, Humacyte Taps New CEO. Blood vessel maker Humacyte's $150 million capital infusion comes with a new CEO. Humacyte's chief medical officer, Dr. Jeffrey Lawson, succeeds longtime president and CEO Kerry Cox, who will stay on with the company as executive chairman. Lawson, who has been involved in Humacyte's technologies for the past two decades. He's worked with the company since its founding in 2004 and was named CMO in 2015. Before joining Humacyte, Lawson held a number of leadership roles at Duke University Medical Center. Cox joined Humacyte as CEO in 2010. She most recently spearheaded negotiations for the company's new global commercialization partnership with Fresenius Medical Care, including the $150 million equity investment. Humacyte is at this true inflection point in the development of our blood vessel, Lawson says. Securing a partnership with one of the most important large corporations in this space is critically important for where we are right now as we plan for the next 18 to 24 months toward commercialization, he said, of the deal with Fresenius. Over the last 24 months, Humacyte has expanded its headcount from 35 employees to about 110 employees. Now we turn to this week's real estate page. And under the heading of Zoning Trends comes the article, Neighborhood Duplexes? Durham ponders. Would you be comfortable with duplexes in your neighborhood? What about triplexes? Do you even know what one looks like? As the housing market tightens throughout Durham, these are some of the questions that city and county planners are asking residents to answer. And their responses could have significant ramifications for housing and new development in the Bull City. Across Durham County, duplexes are permitted on just 3% of properties, according to Durham planners. It's mostly in neighborhoods right around the downtown core, says Hannah Jacobson, senior planner with the Durham City-County Planning Development. In contrast, zoning rules allow single-family homes to be built in 77% of the county. City officials say that allowing denser housing development would help alleviate the region's housing shortage by providing more options, creating opportunities for the city to grow in addition to growing up, Jacobson says. Duplexes and other smaller multifamily developments, such as triplexes and small apartment buildings, also help create more affordable options for putting more units on a single site. The survey could lead the way to future changes in the zoning code, Jacobson says. The housing targeted in the survey is often described as the missing middle, which includes the duplexes, triplexes, townhouses, and small apartment buildings that are in short supply but increase in density. Planners are asking residents directly whether they would be comfortable with having these different types of housing in their neighborhood. These questions are accompanied by photos of different housing types, showing that duplexes and other alternatives don't always look so different from single-family homes. But across the country, it's not uncommon for communities to push back against smaller, multifamily housing in the neighborhood, with current homeowners often citing concerns about traffic and parking. The survey comes as demand for housing continues to outpace supply across the triangle, but nowhere is the market as tight as Durham County, according to the latest data from Triangle Multiple Listing Services. Home builders say shortages in labor and rising material costs are making it more expensive to create new places to live. Many don't see an end in sight to the rising demand or escalating prices. The problem breaks down to a simple equation of supply and demand, real estate professionals say. You've just got this glut of people who are living here in rentals who want to buy, and there simply isn't new housing, said Lisa Ellis, a Durham real estate agent who runs her own firm, Real Estate by Design. Durham County's population currently tops out at just over 300,000. That total is expected to grow by 160,000 over the next three decades, according to Durham planners. And under the heading of sale comes the article, California Firm Beefs Up Multifamily Portfolio. A California-based real estate investment firm has acquired a pair of aging North Hills apartment communities and is planning to merge the two and pump more than $2 million into renovations. Investors Management Group, Inc. paid a combined $26.2 million for the Millbrook Apartments and Lynn Lake Apartments, a price tag that breaks down to $120,183 per unit. Both were built in the mid-1980s. The purchase is the third by IMG since December and won't be the last. We have an intention to buy more assets long-term, says IMG CEO Neil Schimmel. Rents at Millbrook start at $843, while Lynn Lake has units at $783, according to Apartments.com. Schimmel wouldn't say how much the firm plans on raising rents. IMG bought the complexes from New York City real estate firm Greystone, which last acquired the properties in 2014, for a combined $18.4 million. Late last year, the firm made its entry into the Triangle by paying $14.3 million for the 144-unit Somerset Place Apartments in North Raleigh. And closing out the real estate page this week, under the heading of Retail, comes the article, Best Buy Distribution Center Signs Deal Near RTP. Best Buy has signed on as the newest tenant of an industrial park recently built near Research Triangle Park. The consumer electronics company plans to use the 57,000 square foot space as a distribution center, allowing for more efficient delivery of large appliances and televisions throughout the region, according to the company. The new lease deal inked at Liberty Ridge comes as Best Buy looks to ramp up its online sales and move its distribution infrastructure closer to population centers. The once ailing retailer has seen sales rise more recently and is focused on beefing up inventory, ensuring products are available wherever and however a customer might be shopping, according to the Wall Street Journal. The new building is part of an industrial park built by Pennsylvania-based Liberty Property Trust in 2014. The development was speculative, meaning the developers didn't have tenants lined up when construction began. With the Best Buy deal on the books, Liberty Property now has filled all but 79,380 square feet of the 457,500 square foot park just off T.W. Alexander Drive in Durham. That equates to vacancies of just over 17%. This week's Around the State page has the article, California Concern Makes $20 Million Bet on Charlotte. A West Coast commercial real estate firm new to Charlotte will begin a $20 million renovation to a large building in University City later this year. San Diego-based Westcore Properties, which acquired the building at 6800 Selectron Drive in University Research Park about a decade ago, is upfitting the 445,806 square foot building that housed Flex before the company closed its Charlotte operations in 2016. The building in its current state includes about 154,000 square feet of office space and approximately 292,000 square feet of warehouse space, but with repositioning, can be converted into solely office space. We'd love to have a single tenant, but we have the ability to subdivide, says Jessica Brown, executive director at Cushman and Wakefield's Charlotte office. Brown is marketing 6800 Selectron Drive with David Dorsch, senior director at Cushman and Wakefield. Westcore is currently rezoning an adjacent lot to add more surface parking, and there's an option to eventually add structured parking on another part of the site, Brown says. With the initial expanded surface parking, the ratio would become 4.6 spaces per 1,000 square feet, but with structured parking, it could go up to 6 spaces per 1,000 square feet. Westcore has more than 12 million square feet across the U.S., but 6800 Selectron marks its first investment and project in Charlotte, Brown says. They have a lot of experience on the West Coast and have been thought leader in places like San Francisco and Los Angeles, Brown says, adding the firm could bring some of that influence into the building renovation here. They see the opportunity here and not just a vacant flex building. Westcore was at one point looking to sell the property, with it having previously been listed for sale by Cushman & Wakefield, but Brown says the brokerage team pitched the repositioning as another option. All told, 6800 Selectron will include about 453,000 square feet of space, including the existing two-story office space, as well as 300,000 square feet of single-story office space that was formerly production and warehouse space. Well, with that, now we come to the cover story for this week's Triangle Business Journal. And that article is entitled, Downtown Retailers and Eateries Fight to Keep Up with Raleigh and Durham's Growth. June's been a month that Triangle restaurateurs might want to forget. A franchise of the Pie Hole dessert shop filed for bankruptcy earlier this month after less than a year of serving up inventive pie slices, think Earl Grey tea and Mexican chocolate, on Durham's 9th Street. A day earlier, Bull City mainstay Nana's made public that it would be serving its last steaks by July 1st, ending a quarter-century long run on University Drive. In Raleigh, Kimbap owner Kim Hunter decided to close her Korean-inspired comfort food eatery after 5 years at Seaboard Station. Revenue had hit a bumpy patch, and she was happy with how far the restaurant had come, so she closed shop. A few days later, downtown staple Buku announced it would be moving to Cary by early next year. While the owners say they have plans to open a new downtown restaurant, Buku's absence leaves a hole at the busy corner of Davie and Wilmington Streets that won't be filled by another eatery. Instead, software company Red Hat is moving one of its marketing teams into the ground floor space. Sean Degnan, a Buku owner, says the restaurant would have been facing a steep lease increase if it stuck around. Had we stayed in Red Hat, we would have been in that scenario of the rent coming close to doubling, Degnan says. Despite the Triangle's booming economy, locally owned restaurants and retail shops are in an uphill battle to keep up across the downtowns of Raleigh and Durham, and in other dense nodes of first floor commercial shops such as Durham's 9th Street and Raleigh's North Hills. The spree of recent closing have run the gamut from decades-old community mainstays to new concepts that didn't quite stick. Their primary reasons for closing vary widely. In some cases, the culprit is actually related to the Triangle's growth and all that comes with it, the rising rents, lower unemployment, and a shortage of workers. In other instances, small businesses might find themselves in a part of town that hasn't quite fully developed yet, leaving the sidewalks and cash register lines empty for much of the week. In downtown Raleigh, for example, the number of first-floor restaurant and retail shop closures has seen a small uptick in the past 2 years, according to data tracked by the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. And the ratio between openings and closings has actually decreased slightly in the past 3 years, meaning that for every one business that closes, fewer new businesses are opening. But that isn't to say that small restaurants and retailers are tanking in the Triangle's city centers. Openings continue to far outpace closings in the downtowns of both Raleigh and Durham, as new businesses wait to swoop into spaces vacated by recent closures. And hip new names and experimental concepts are popping up, from an axe-throwing bar in Durham to the new Alamo Draft House in Raleigh. But making it work financially remains a challenge for many, and it could get more difficult as prices rise. The rents are too high. The cost of doing business is too high, says Lou Mishakos, owner of LM Restaurants. Mishakos has put more than $11 million into a three-story building on Glenwood Avenue that is now home to two of his restaurants, Vidrio and Carolina Ale House. And he admits he's a few years away from recouping his investment. Parking costs and the labor squeeze continue to put pressure on business. And while bars have proliferated, there still aren't enough eateries to support foot traffic outside of Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evenings. The rest of the week is very soft, he says. There's a battle many restaurants and retailers are fighting in downtown Raleigh. Not all locations are equal, says Bill King, Downtown Raleigh Alliance's Senior Vice President of Economic Development and Planning. There's a lot of storefronts scattered all over downtown Raleigh. Some of them have excellent foot traffic. You could open anything in them, and they would succeed. Other places have a lot of room for growth. Downtown Raleigh is still in a stage of its development in which there are clusters of businesses that draw consistent food traffic, but the places in between can be like ghost corridors. Glenwood South and the Warehouse District are examples of areas with a growing storefront presence that still lack daytime traffic. Some of those businesses have struggled in those two districts because of that, King says. But new development can change the equation. That's part of the bet Kane Realty Corporation has made in the Warehouse District with its 18-story tower, the Dillon. Among the ground floor tenants that have signed on to activate the streetscape is Urban Outfitters. With hundreds of new residential units in the buildings above, developers are wagering that downtown retail can thrive on a street that's virtually empty today. Landing national chains might not be the most popular move with the locals, but it does add a measure of stability to a neighborhood's storefronts. That's the opinion of Charlie Coyne, a senior vice president at CBRE, who specializes in retail. Contrary to what a lot of small business owners think, getting some national brands downtown is good for everybody, he says. For King, the key is clumping tenants together. What the Dillon will have is cluster, he says. You can go there, and you'll understand there will be a number of ground floor businesses you can go into. While downtown development can help activate ground floor retail and restaurant space, it can also contribute to the obstacles restaurateurs and small shopkeepers face. Since 2003, more than $2.2 billion has been pumped into downtown Raleigh in the form of private and public development, totaling 7.3 million square feet of new construction, according to the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. But with the new apartment buildings and office towers, have come higher lease rates for ground floor tenants looking to sell their wares. We're seeing more and more stores trying to figure out how they're going to keep up with the cost in rent, says Jennifer Martin, executive director of the Greater Raleigh Merchants Association. Downtown retail lease rates in Raleigh reached $29.75 per square foot by the end of 2017, almost double the rate charged as recently as 12 months earlier, when the average rate was $16.74, according to data from commercial real estate firm JLL. Prices have similarly risen in downtown Durham, where the average retail lease was $21.42 per square foot at the end of 2017. The difference in the Bull City is that lease rates started much lower than in Raleigh, but have risen steadily over the past decade. In 2006, retail leases averaged just $5 per square foot, but consistently climbed from there as the city's smaller, more condensed downtown was overhauled with restaurants, shiny new condos, and mixed-use towers. In Raleigh, retail leases hovered between $13 and $18 per square foot from 2006 to 2016, before ramping up drastically in the last 18 months. Much of the increase can be attributed to new developments such as the Dillon, analysts with JLL say. Many shopkeepers are still locked into older leases, meaning they haven't felt the impacts yet of rising rates. But rent increases are something that new small business owners will have to begin planning for. It doesn't mean it's prohibitive, says King of the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. We have small businesses that are doing well that are paying those rates. But it is something that shop owners and restaurateurs have to weigh before making a commitment. And new entrepreneurs in the food industry, and especially retail, already have a more difficult time raising money. Banks don't lend as easily, particularly to retailers, King says. And first-time business owners may not have the collateral to leverage for upfront costs, such as tenant upfits. This was one of the warnings that Hunter of Kimpat offered to others who may be considering opening up a variety or retail shop. She raised her startup money through family and friends, and in hindsight, didn't start with enough of a cushion. After paying contractors to finish the space, there wasn't much left. That was kind of scary, she says. And the costs don't end with lease payments. In general, the price of doing business has increased downtown, business owners say. Parking in particular has begun to add up. Our staff, it costs them too, so that takes a toll, says Degnan of Buku. Server doesn't necessarily want to drive downtown for a lunch shift and pay $10 for parking to work for $40 or $50. The statistics on store closures aren't broken down by type of shop, but Martin believes the pressures are greatest on retailers. Outside of the thinner profit margins, retailers are hyper-dependent on location, and many are wilting under the competition brought by online shopping. To combat these forces, some shop owners are turning to less conventional retail setups. On Durham's 9th Street, the Playhouse Toy Store had to liquidate its inventory this spring after more than three decades in business. Owner Donna Frederick attributes the shop's woes to competition from online retailers, similar to the pressures that pushed Toys R Us out of business. Frederick is now on a crusade to transform the shop into a multi-tenant space, where smaller, local merchants and artisans can sign short-term leases to sell their wares in a shared space. They have a space to feature their items because they couldn't do it on their own, and we needed help on the rent, she says of the arrangement. DRA's King says multi-tenant concepts allow people with smaller operations to test the market without having to come up with piles of money and take on major risk. He cites the food hall structure as something that could provide a boost to the local food scene in downtown Raleigh as rents continue to rise. People are biting off a little bit less, he says of the concept. Even the shop owners who are successful concede that retail is an uphill battle. Pam Blondin is combining her shop's Deco and Deco Home into a larger space in July, just around the corner from the existing shop on Hargett Street. But the move has come with a lot of debt, and Blondin hasn't paid herself in 6 months. That's part of the sacrifice it takes to make retail work, she says. But now, Blondin's shop has helped keep street life alive on a corner of downtown Raleigh. Deco's new home would likely have become offices on the ground floor had it not been for the move, Blondin says. With a critical mass of shops now on the block, she's more confident about the future. A lot of the businesses I see open and close is because they're sitting by themselves, she says. I think there's power in numbers. For those trying to make it on their own, even small hiccups can provide exceedingly costly. When Sunny Miller, moved her shop, Adara Spa, to a property she bought on Peace Street less than 2 years ago, she found herself facing unexpected costs. The new building didn't meet some of the regulations in the zoning code, which she hadn't known before closing on the purchase. Miller had to spend big to create ADA access to the building and other improvements, bringing the property into compliance with the city, an endeavor that wound up costing her $40,000. That meant putting off other expenses, including air conditioning and a new sign. Fast forward 18 months, and the spa still doesn't have a sign. 3 times in the last week, people have walked in and commented to Miller that she should put some kind of signage outside to let the people know the spa was in the neighborhood. It's not like that we don't know we need a sign, she says. It costs money. With a small business, you have to do things as you can. Miller tried to get a grant from the city aimed at helping downtown retailers with outfits, but she didn't qualify. Technically, the spa is not a retail shop, and the downtown boundary for the grant program ends just across the street at a Starbucks, of all the places, Miller says. She ended up applying for a different grant from the city that provides half the cost for renovations and was able to install new flooring and an AC unit. She's still saving up for a sign. The Downtown Raleigh Alliance has similar grant programs. But Miller and others say they'd like to see more support for local businesses, which provide the vibrancy and character to the Triangle's urban centers that make them attractive places for big-time companies and residents in new, pricey apartments. The state and local governments are quick to offer large incentive packages to corporations looking to set up shop here, they say. We invest a lot with the big guys who have deeper pockets, but we don't always invest in the small little guys who are already here, Merchant Associations Martin says. Now, associated with the cover story, there are a couple of graphs. Let me just use a couple of them here for your information. One is on skyrocketing rents. And they give the lease rate between the first quarter of 2006 and the first quarter of 2018. Now, for Durham, the first quarter of 2006 is $5.06, whereas in 2018, it's $22.24. For Raleigh, those comparable numbers are $11.44 for the first quarter of 2006 and $29.75 for the first quarter of 2018. Also in this article is a graph that talks about the number of closings versus openings from the years 2011 to 2017. And rather than read each of those, let me just read the ones for 2011 and 2017. So in 2011, there were 6 closings and 14 openings. But in 2017, there were 17 closings and 24 openings. Next for this week's Triangle Business Journal comes an article that was originally published in the Sports Business Journal, which is an affiliated publication to TBJ. And it's about the movie Bull Durham that turns 30 this year. The article's entitled, No Bull, All Steak. From lollygaggers to those who worship at the Church of Baseball, millions of fans, players, and executives have long considered Bull Durham a shorthand for the daily joys and sorrows of life in the minor leagues. It also boosted the bottom line, both for the real-life Bulls and for many other big league farm teams, and rekindled a love affair with small-town sports. Bull Durham, released on June 15, 1988, became an improbable hit. An R-rated, occasionally raunchy romantic comedy set in Class A Carolina League, bereft of any triumphant championship crescendos. It cemented Kevin Costner's status as a rising box office star. Just before filming for Bull Durham began, he filmed The Untouchables and No Way Out, both of which arrived in the summer of 1987. The movie also jump-started Susan Sarandon to the A-list and rescued a young actor named Tim Robbins from the embarrassment 2 years earlier of a lead role in George Lucas's cringe-inducing Howard the Duck. Filmed for $8 million, Bull Durham pulled in $50 million at the box office and then went on to become one of the best-selling sports movies on home video. In 2003, Sports Illustrated named it the best sports movie ever. Bull Durham brought minor league baseball into the country's consciousness in a way that had probably skipped a generation or two, said Pat O'Connor, president and CEO of Minor League Baseball, the governing body for 176 teams. It wasn't an overnight thing. It was the first ball bearing running down the track, and it's going to trigger subsequent events. There's no question it was one of the major catalysts. The Bulls went from successful hometown team to national phenomenon in a hurry. Souvenir sales jumped to $500,000 the year after the movie came out, compared with $50,000 annually before the movie, and have been robust ever since. Although specific figures aren't available, Durham's the only minor league club to rank among the 25 top-selling teams for each of the 25 years Minor League Baseball has compiled licensed merchandise sales figures. Miles Wolf, who brought the Bulls and Minor League Baseball Park to Durham and Durham Athletic Park in 1980, after a decade without a team, took his investment group's initial $35,000 investment, no, that's not a typo, in 1979, and converted that into a reported sale price of $4 million 12 years later to Capital Broadcasting Company, who still owns the team. By 2016, the Bulls were worth an estimated $39 million, according to Forbes, ranking seventh on the magazine's list of the most valuable minor league teams. Another AAA team, the Sacramento Rivercats, topped the list at $49 million. Those estimates seem to be in the ballpark, if not a little low. The Class A Dayton Dragons, number three on the list at $45 million, have been sold for a reported $40 million in 2014. To many in the industry, Bull Durham stands as a milestone in the renaissance of minor league baseball itself. At minimum, the movie reminded people of the sublimity of small-scale ballparks, silly mascots, wacky promotions, and the intimacy of fans being able to chat with ballplayers, hoping to someday reach the show. The sign on the outfield wall reading, "Hit Bull, Win Stake," was actually a creation of the movie, but it evoked the promotional wizardry that had existed for a century at ballparks across the country and continues to be exemplified by the likes of Mike Veek, the co-owner of multiple minor league teams, who has made events such as Vasectomy Night a staple of minor league life. "Don't forget, for a long time, baseball had been down," said Chuck Greenberg, who owns three minor league teams and is the former CEO of the Texas Rangers. "That coincided with building baseball stadiums that didn't feel much like baseball parks in the 60s and 70s. And then Bull Durham came along. It really was taking a page out of yesteryear. The traditional look and feel of the ballpark, it just touched a nerve." Writer-director Ron Shelton's memorable script and movie may have never advanced to Hollywood's version of The Show if not for Wolf and one of his minority investors, Tom Mount. Mount grew up in Durham and went on to become the head of Universal Studios. Before purchasing a stake in the Bulls, Mount and another investor, Van Schley, began buying minor league teams in the late 70s, becoming one of the first groups of increasingly sophisticated and entertainment-friendly investors to put souvenirs and memorable promotions together with improved stadiums and concessions menus. Mount encouraged Shelton, who spent 5 years as a minor league infielder in the Orioles system, to pursue an idea revolving around heartache and lunacy in the minors. In 1986, he sent Shelton to Durham, another Carolina League outpost, to kick the tires on the idea. Shelton chose Durham, as Mount had hoped he would, but never mentioned to the director. The film exceeded everyone's expectations, Mount said, and it did very well, but not just financially. It helped reinvigorate minor league baseball everywhere. Suddenly, everybody I knew in Hollywood wanted to buy a minor league team. Now we come to the executive voice section of today's, of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and the executive voice belongs to Robert Olds. Bart Olds has been a full-time resident of the Triangle since November. In that short time, the 36-year-old head of asset management at Carlin Real Estate has already begun to see his vision take shape across a broad swath of Research Triangle Park. Since last year, his firm has acquired nearly 2.5 million square feet of office and lab space and 650 acres of land in the park, most notably the 1.75 million square foot Palmer RTP campus, formerly owned by GlaxoSmithKline. Olds has launched an ambitious $80 million overhaul of the campus, complete with a food truck promenade, concert space, and a $1 million glass wall treehouse that doubles as a conference room, all with the aim of drawing new tenants and a younger generation of tech and life sciences workers into RTP. It was something I had wanted to do personally for a long time, a Silicon Valley-style campus, but with a multi-tenant environment, Olds says. Olds is betting that Carlin is getting in ahead of the curve. He sees the Triangle as a younger version of Austin, Texas, where his firm has developed a similar office and lab campus. We thought it would only be a matter of time before a West Coast tech giant made a splash here, he says. We wanted to be on the forefront of that wave. So following is a Q&A that Triangle Business Journal conducted with Bart Olds. What is your first job out of college? I come from a long line of attorneys, and at one point I thought I wanted to follow in their footsteps. So I decided to test the waters and started as a paralegal for a Cleveland, Ohio-based law firm. I quickly discovered that law was not the career path for me, and after a lot of soul-searching, I moved to Washington, D.C. to pursue a career in real estate. So how did you break into real estate and development? Believe it or not, I got my first job in real estate off Craigslist. It sounds sketchy, I know, but it was an amazing opportunity working for a family office, Bonaventure Realty Group, doing value-add multifamily investments. Bonaventure Realty Group specializes in multifamily investments and property management throughout the Mid-Atlantic region. At a very young age, I was able to manage projects ranging from $5,000 to $100,000 per unit in renovations. It was a fantastic opportunity that laid the foundation for my career in real estate. So what first drew your attention to the Triangle? My parents relocated to the Triangle in 2007. I would make the biannual visits for holidays and couldn't help but notice the changing landscape every time I would visit. The sheer amount of development piqued my interest into the market and ultimately led to Palmer Innovation Centers making a $250 million commitment into a one-mile radius in RTP. What convinced you and your firm to make such a big commitment here? The original Palmer Innovation Center is located in Austin, Texas, and we were always searching for the next Austin. We believe that Raleigh-Durham's growth and demographics are very much in line with that of Austin. Raleigh-Durham is on almost every list imaginable in terms of ranking from the best foodie cities to the highest educated populations. Additionally, we believed it was only a matter of time before West Coast-based companies made a push into the Triangle due to the affordability, diverse population, and educated workforce. So what's been your favorite non-work-related part of living in the Triangle? After being in California for the last 8 years, it's nice to be back in the South. There's really a sense of community you don't find in most parts of the world. A simple wave or a smile goes a long way to brighten someone's day. People are always willing to go out of their way to spread a little joy. So is there a specific project you're most proud of in your career thus far? I am most proud of what we've been able to build here in the Triangle. In under a year, we've acquired 2.4 million square feet and 650 acres. And we are not done yet. We're just getting started on our $80 million renovation of Palmer RTP. Construction is starting this month and will include a treehouse conference center, amphitheater, 3,000 square foot outdoor pavilion, a two-story 11,000 square foot gym with a slide, volleyball courts, upgraded parking, permanent food truck facilities, and much more. Additionally, we already have three tennis courts, two basketball courts, pickleball court, hockey, soccer area, fishing ponds, running and fitness trails, hammock parks, bike share program, and a video arcade. So what's one of the biggest challenges you faced in your career? How did you overcome it? I was laid off during the Great Recession from my dream job in 2008. I was working in high-end multifamily development in Washington, D.C., and loving every minute. I ended up bouncing around government consulting for the next year plus, until I decided to go back to school at the University of Southern California to pursue my Master's of Real Estate Development. My time at USC ultimately led me to my current gig. Note, I also attended the University of South Carolina for undergrad, so I'm a double USC graduate, just different coasts. So what keeps you up at night? My kids, Tyler, Gigi, and Harlow, and heartburn. What's your favorite place for business lunch? Matteo in downtown Durham. What books are on your nightstand? Currently, I'm working my way through The New Geography of Jobs by University of California, Berkeley economics professor Enrico Moretti. The book is a fascinating look at why some U.S. cities have prospered, like Raleigh-Durham, and others have declined. And finally, from today's Triangle Business Journal comes the heading, Toll Road Trouble, and the article is North Carolina House Approval Opens Door to Possible Changes. State lawmakers took a step toward allowing a possible buyout or changes to the Interstate 77 toll lanes contract with a private operator. But several possible hurdles loom if it gains approval from the full General Assembly. The House passed an amendment by Mecklenburg Republican John Bradford to use credit balances from the Highway Fund and Highway Trust Fund to spend as much as $300 million to end or revamp the current agreement. To take effect, the State Senate must also approve the measure. If the General Assembly moves forward with the legislation, any credit balances used for changes to the I-77 contract would have to be repaid within a decade through toll revenue. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be certain to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long till next time. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, call us at 919-832-5138. 5138.